No. The earliest flight was tomorrow morning. He repeated the search, this time with New York JFK as the destination. There was one flight remaining today, a JetBlue shuttle leaving in 3 hours. Chapter 14. New York City. By 10:15, they were leaving the airport in their rental car, a Hyundai Sonata, and getting on the Van Wyck Expressway into Queens. With Ephraim navigating from his cell phone screen, Jack took them across the Bronx Whitestone Bridge and picked up Interstate 91, which they would take north. 30 minutes outside New Haven, Jack got another Inquestor alert. "Read it," he told Ephraim.
Something about a motel in Hartford. It's a Best Western. A room charge, I think."
"How long ago?"
60 minutes. "Where is Hartford?"
"About 45 minutes north of New Haven, and that much closer to the Canadian border."
"Why stop in Hartford?" asked Ephraim. "Why not find a rest stop and pull in for a nap? Why advertise your location?"
"Maybe he thinks he's free and clear. I left his credit card as I'd found it. If he'd been suspicious, he wouldn't have used it at all."
"I guess.
What do you want to do?" Jack thought about it. If Mueller had stopped for the night, they had plenty set up on the hotel before morning. If, on the other hand, Mueller paid for a room and then just kept heading north, they'd already lost him. They'd never catch up.
"Let's do the legwork," Jack replied.
Shortly before midnight, they pulled into Mike's Mini Mart, which was on Sawmill Road not far from 95. Jack was relieved to see the interior lights on and a glowing neon sign that read, "Open 24/7. He pulled into a spot in front of the propane tank cage and shut off the engine. A couple teenage boys sat on the curb before the store's doors, drinking slushies and balancing their skateboards on their laps.
"They should be in bed," Ephraim said. "Isn't this a school night?"
"Go have a chat with them. I'll go inside." Jack opened his door, and Ephraim went to do the same. Jack turned back.
"I was kidding. Stay in the car, or you might end up wearing a slushie."
Jack opened the Sonata's rear door, grabbed his jacket, and put it on. He pushed through the doors and walked straight to the counter. A teenage boy with a wispy light brown mustache and acne on his chin stood at the register. Jack's odds had just improved.
"Evening," Jack said.
"Hey.
Wondering if you can help me."
Jack pulled his private investigator's badge out, showed it to the kid, returned it to his blazer pocket.
"What's your name?"
If the kid was going to balk at Jack's credentials, it would happen now.
Nate.
"How long have you been here, Nate?"
8 months, I guess."
"Tonight," Jack replied.
"Oh, since 4.
"I'm looking for a guy. He bought gas here at 5:35. From his pocket, Jack took the photocopy he'd made of Stefan Mueller's passport folder. "Does he look familiar?"
"I don't know. Maybe."
Jack put a little steel in his voice. "He was here. You were here. He came in and bought sticks. Do you recognize him?"
"Yeah, I think so."
Jack gestured at the trio of tiny black and white video monitors sitting on the counter beside the register. "Do those work?"
"Yeah, but just the pumps. The one in here's busted."
"Show me," Jack replied. Without waiting to be invited, he walked behind the counter. The kid hesitated a bit now, so Jack nudged him. It was about 5:30. Which pump did he use?
Okay, just a sec."
Nate knelt before a DVD-like box on the shelf beneath the monitors and rewound the footage until the counter read 1725.
"You're doing good. Think back. Which pump?" 3. No, 2. That monitor on the left."
"Okay, hit fast forward," Jack replied. "Easy, not too fast." When the counter clicked over to 1731, a dark blue or black sedan pulled up to the pump. The driver's side door opened. Out climbed Stefan Mueller.
Hey, that's him,
Nate blurted, currently warming to the task. It's him, right? The beard.
Yep, that's him. You've got a good eye.
What did he buy? Don't think, just say the first thing that pops into your head.
Chocolate milk, tuna sandwich, bag of Fritos.
Can you enlarge that pump picture? I need the license plate.
I can zoom in, but it's not optical, you know. Just digital. It'll get all pixelated. It might be better on the office TV, though.
Where?
Straight down that hall on the left.
Thanks.
Jack followed Nate's directions and pushed through a swinging door bearing the scrawled words "Employees Only" in red permanent marker. At the front of the store, a warning bing-bong chime sounded. Jack glanced over his shoulder to see Nate giving him a thumbs up. Most exciting day of the kid's life, Jack thought. He was in a storeroom. On the left-hand wall was a steel shelving unit holding rolls of toilet paper, bottles of floor cleaner, and cases of soda and water. In the corner, on a small card table, sat an 18-inch flat-screen television. Nate had already transferred the security camera image to it.
Zooming in, Nate called enthusiastically.
10-4, Jack replied.
Slowly, the image enlarged, panning and tightening on Muller's license plate as it expanded.
Hold, Jack called.
The image froze. Nate was right. The image was growing badly pixelated, but it would have to do. Emblazoned across the bottom of the plate were the words "Taxation Without Representation," which made it a Washington, D.C. plate, but the camera angle was such that Jack could make out only the first two letters, E.B. The four characters to the right of the D.C. flag icon were blurred. Jack returned to the front of the store. Nate asked, "Get it?"
Got it. I owe you, Nate. See you later.
Jack was halfway to the door when Nate called,
Hey, he took a map or something too, if that's him,
asked Jack.
From the rack beside the chips, behind you.
Jack turned. The rack was waist high, with vertical slots for 20 to 30 travel brochures, maps, bus and train schedules, and restaurant coupons.
Nate, did you see which one he took?
No, sorry, man.
Just one or a bunch?
Nate screwed up his face, thinking.
Not a bunch. One, maybe two.
Jack returned to the Sonata and climbed in beside Ephraim, who asked, Any luck?
I'm not sure.
What's that mean?
Muller took something. A map or brochure.
So? Asked Ephraim.
How long between the time he got gas and he checked into the Best Western in Hartford?
5 hours, give or take?
But it's at most an hour drive.
What was he doing the rest of the time?
Jack was missing something. He could feel it nibbling at the back of his brain like a song you can hear but can't name.
He closed his eyes and mentally backtracked.
Huh, he muttered.
He got out of the car and went back into the store.
Hey, Nate, you still have that picture on the office TV?
Yeah.
You're the man. Be right back.
Jack walked to the office and sat down at the card table and stared at the image of Muller standing beside his car. Jack leaned in, squinted. The car was a Ford Fusion, hybrid. Jack walked out, gave Nate a dude and a thumbs up, then returned to the car.
Ephraim, Google this.
Ford Fusion Hybrid Tank Size and Range. It took 30 seconds.
14 gallons, 43 miles per gallon highway. So that makes the range 600 miles per tank.
It's 300 miles from D.C. to here, and he put in $13 worth of gas.
That's what, 7 gallons?
Yeah, half a tank, Ephraim confirmed.
Then he drives 40 miles up the road to Hartford and checks into the Best Western. Why stop here? Why not push through?
Maybe he was hungry.
And why use a credit card for such a small purchase?
Muller's too savvy to not be carrying emergency cash.
You think he's leading us? Leaving breadcrumbs?
It's very possible.
The idea that Mueller would use the credit card Jack had found in the Alexandria motel room had been a stretch from the beginning. Wanting to believe in something isn't the same as it being real, Jack reminded himself. On the other hand, why would Mueller bother playing them at all? Why not disappear? Jack had no answer. He grabbed his phone and called up the last Inquestor alert on Mueller's credit card. Best Western Hartford Hotel and Suites, 185 Brainerd Road, Hartford, Connecticut, 06114, pre-auth room charge. Jack showed Ephraim the screen and said, "It's a pre-authorization, not a charge." "Oh, man, sorry. Forget it. I should have caught it. Mueller doesn't have a passport, or he would have gotten on a plane, and you can't rent a room without showing identification." "What now? Have we lost him?" "Go back inside and grab brochures for Amtrak, Metro North, and Greyhound. Nate's seen my face too much." Ephraim did as Jack asked and returned a minute later with the schedules. He handed them to Jack. "What are you thinking, Jack?" "Greyhound allows prepaid or gift tickets. Someone else buys it, and the passenger picks it up at the station with a password. As for trains, it's not as easy to get a ticket without ID, but it's doable. Once you're aboard, if you can bypass the random checks, you're set. Somebody like Mueller would find a way to make it work." Jack scanned the schedules. Greyhound, Amtrak, and Shoreline East were hubbed at New Haven's Union Station, about 10 minutes to the north. But the Metro North Railroad had a station in West Haven itself, about 200 yards south of Mike's Mini Mart. Jack explained his thinking to Ephraim, who said, "Let's say you're right. Let's say he stopped here because it's close to the West Haven station. Where could he go from here?" "And why not drive another 10 minutes to New Haven?" Jack added. "Union Station would give him a lot more travel options." Jack could feel his brain spiraling as it tried to plot all the variables. He caught himself and pulled back. He'd learned the hard way that the only way to stop the spiral was to make a choice, to take action, whether right or wrong. Jack studied the schedules again. On instinct, he dismissed Greyhound. Too confined, he decided. If pressed, it would be easier to maneuver and hide on a train. That left trains, Amtrak, Shoreline East, Metro North. Jack said, "Let's think it through. If Mueller's goal is still the Canadian border, he'd want as straight a shot as possible. Shoreline only goes as far north as New London, so scratch that. If he takes Amtrak up to Boston, he's got a lot more destination options, but more transfers." Ephraim added, "More chances for delays and complications. Bigger stations, tighter security." "That leaves Metro North," Jack said. "And leaves him..." He traced his finger down the schedule grid. "The Waterbury line. 2 departures, 7:30 and 10:50. Ephraim checked his watch. It left over an hour ago. The train had left, but Jack was by no means certain Mueller had been on either it or the earlier one. As reasoned as their speculation was, it was still speculation. But maybe there was a way to confirm it. In that moment, Jack felt the absurdity of the situation crash down on him. One phone call to the Secret Service and Mueller's chances of escape would drop to almost nil. Yet here he was, sitting in the parking lot of a gas station, posing as a private investigator with a rookie journalist while studying train schedules. Just hit speed dial, Jack thought, and it's finished. No. He could sense he was locked into the same course he'd chosen just hours after he'd been attacked. He was being impulsive, undisciplined, focused on the trees rather than the forest. All the things Jerry Hendley had cited as reason for his exile from the campus. Jack didn't care. With Ephraim navigating, Jack drove south down Sawmill Road to Railroad Avenue and turned right. The station's parking lot, divided into north and south areas that sat astride the tracks and the red brick and glass terminal building, was several acres of blacktop enclosed by a hurricane fence. Under the glow of street lamps, Jack could see that this lot, the northernmost one, was a quarter full of cars, but there were no pedestrians visible. It made sense. The evening's last train had left.
"You really think he'd park in here?" asked Ephraim.
"No, but I would if I were him. As long as you're paid up, nobody'll give your car a second glance. If I were on the run, I wouldn't bother hunting for public parking in the middle of the night."
"A lot of cars."
"Don't kill the mood," Jack replied. When Jack reached the lot entrance, he turned in, then followed the pavement arrow into the west side of the lot. "We're looking for a dark Ford Fusion hybrid," Jack said.
"DC plates, right? EB something."
"Right.
Don't key on that. He might have swapped plates."
Jack started down the first row, eyes fixed on the cars out his window, while Ephraim did the same on his side, murmuring to himself, "No, wrong color. That's an SUV. Oh, close, but not quite right."
Jack had to smile. It was hard not to like the kid.
Kid, Jack thought. He didn't have that many years on Ephraim. Not chronologically, at least. They reached the end of the row, turned, and started down the next one.
"Ford Fusion," Ephraim called out. "Can't tell if it's a hybrid. Maryland plates."
"Check it," Jack replied, breaking to a stop. "Check the interior for a bottle of milk, sandwich wrapper, bag of Fritos." As Ephraim climbed out, Jack added, "And a rental agency sticker, or what looks like the remains of one." Ephraim returned 30 seconds later.
"Nothing. Not a hybrid."
They kept going and finished the remaining two rows without finding another match. Jack returned to the entrance, crossed over to the adjoining lot, and continued the search. More confident now, they made short work of the first and second rows and were turning into the final one when Ephraim blurted, "Gotcha!" Jack stopped the car and glanced out Ephraim's window. Ford Fusion Hybrid, DC plates, EB9836. "Go," Jack said. Ephraim hopped out, circled the car, peeking in windows as he went, then returned. He leaned down and said through the open window, "Frito bag, but no sign of a rental sticker."
"You're sure?"
100%.
Jack had assumed Mueller's backup car would have also been a rental. If this was a privately owned vehicle, they had another lead. "Take a pic of the VIN," he ordered. Chapter 15, West Haven, Connecticut. They had a victory, but it was minor and fleeting. Mueller was likely on Metro North's Waterbury branch, but there were 6 stops north of West Haven, from Derby Shelton to Waterbury, and according to the schedule, the train had already passed all but the final 2, Naugatuck and Waterbury itself. Jack said, "I need a route."
"On it," Ephraim said, studying his phone's screen. "Head back down 95. We're looking for Prindle Road. It's 30-35 minutes. We'll miss the train by 5 minutes.
Waterbury, then."
40 minutes. It's going to be very close."
A few miles outside West Haven, as Prindle turned into Highway 114, Jack set the Sonata's cruise control a couple miles an hour faster than the speed limit. They drove in silence for a while, Jack lost in a game of what if Mueller does X, and Ephraim checking his emails. After a time, he asked Jack, "Did you get a chance to sort through Hahn's email data?"
"Not yet. I don't know how much I'll find. Beyond the basics, it's not my area of expertise."
"Why didn't you say so? I know a guy."
"What guy?"
"A source," Ephraim said. "One of my many."
"Well, okay. He's a friend. He's trustworthy. I'll shoot him an email and see if he's willing."
"Okay."
Jack had a list of questions he'd been compiling for Ephraim, starting with how he got onto the disappearance of René Almon in the first place. Next, how had he not only succeeded in discovering Almon was alive, but also been able to track him down when both France's military and civilian intelligence agencies had failed at the task?
And why did Ephraim believe the soldier had been false flagged?
The list went on. For now, Jack decided to satisfy his general curiosity about the man himself.
Tell me about Almon.
He's a lot like you and me, actually.
How so?
Born into a legacy, Ephraim replied. Rene's a fifth-generation soldier going back to the Napoleonic Wars and the Battle of Waterloo. Rene graduated top of his class at Saint-Cyr, the first of his line to pull it off. Saint-Cyr, or the École Spéciale Militaire de Saint-Cyr, was France's version of West Point. Both of them had been founded at roughly the same time, in 1802.
Jack had encountered a few Saint-Cyr graduates along the way. Without exception, they were superb soldiers. Ephraim went on. After that, Almon had his choice of assignments, but he took the hard route, which surprised no one from what I gather. He requested and got the 1st Rifleman Regiment out of Epinal.
Standard infantry, Jack replied.
It had been his father's last command. Whether he did it to honor his dad or to better himself is anyone's guess.
Either way, he's not the type to desert.
No chance. According to friends of his I interviewed, René loved the army. He'd been wishy-washy,
so to speak. But once at Saint-Cyr, he blossomed.
It stands to reason if he'd been captured and then managed to escape, he would have let someone know.
I would think so.
No one's heard from him. Not his father, not his friends, or even his fiancée. Unless he's lost his mind, he's doing what he's doing for a reason.
How sure are you the man you saw in Lyon was René?
90%.
I'll show you the photos later. You can judge for yourself.
Good, Jack replied. And the next time we come up for air, I'll want details, Ephraim. All of them.
Deal.
They weren't going to make it, Jack estimated, watching the Sonata's dashboard clock. They were 10 minutes from the Waterbury station. The train was only 4 minutes out. Unless Müller lingered, they would miss him. Jack pressed harder on the gas pedal.
They passed Waterbury's city limit sign 8 minutes later. At Ephraim's direction, Jack turned onto Freight Street, crossed the Naugatuck River, then turned right onto Meadow. A couple 100 yards down, past a red brick clock tower and across the street from a park, lay the train station, little more than a long raised platform covered by an aluminum awning lit by sodium vapor lights. There appeared to be no office and no parking lot attendant.
The lot's coming up on our right, Ephraim warned. Jack slowed the Sonata. He checked the dashboard clock. The train had pulled in 5 minutes ago.
Outside his window, Jack glimpsed a figure, a man, based on his build and gait, passing beneath the trees bordering the sidewalk. He glanced that way, but in the darkness he could make out no details of the person's face. As far as Jack could see, the man carried neither luggage nor a briefcase.
Is it? Asked Ephraim.
Can't tell. You see anyone else around?
Ephraim was staring out his window at the train platform.
A couple people, but they're too far away for faces.
Jack pulled to the curb and watched in his side mirror as the figure continued down the sidewalk. After a few moments, the person was swallowed by the darkness.
Jack made a snap decision. You're driving. Go down the block, then left on the next street. See if you can catch him coming the other way. Be careful. If it's him, he knows your face. Stay in touch.
Jack opened his door and climbed out. As Ephraim slid into the driver's seat, he asked,
What are you going to do?
Check out the platform.
As Ephraim pulled away, Jack crossed the street to the entrance of the dirt parking lot and paused beside a tree. He pulled up the hood on his jacket.
Waterbury was a good 350 miles north of Alexandria, and Jack could feel the difference in the chill night air.
The lot before him was large, enough for a few hundred cars, but he counted fewer than 10, all in a line before the platform. The area had an industrial feel, with what looked like warehouses on the opposite side of the tracks, and beyond these, the highway cloverleaf. Jack got the impression the station had been placed here out of necessity rather than for convenience.
In the distance, Jack could hear the faint rush of cars on I-84. After a minute of watching and seeing no one, Jack strode into the lot and headed for the platform. He broke into a jog, playing the desperate traveler afraid he'd missed the train. 50 feet from the line of parked cars, one of them started backing out, its reverse lights bright in the darkness. It was a white Subaru. "Aw, man," Jack called and stopped running. He checked his watch, then called, "Damn!" At the same time, he reached under the hem of his jacket and drew his Glock. Whether his showmanship was impressing the car's occupant, Jack didn't know, but he decided to err on the side of caution. If Muller was inside this car, Jack was an easy target. He had no cover. 20 feet ahead, the Subaru slowed its reverse course, did a Y turn, then headed toward Jack. The headlights pinned him. The car picked up speed, veering slightly left to take Jack down its passenger side. As the Subaru drew even with him, the passenger window rolled down a couple of inches. Through the gap came faint strains of easy-listening jazz. "Hey," a man's voice called from the car's darkened interior. Jack could see nothing through the window. "You looking for the train? You just missed it." Jack dropped his head in dejection, shading his face with the hood, and raised his hand in thanks. "Really? No one else got off?" "Just my wife. Sorry." The voice didn't sound like Muller's, Jack thought. Unless he was disguising his voice, that was. It seemed unlikely. Why stop at all? Why not just drive on past? "You need help or something?" the voice asked. "Nah, thanks," Jack replied in his best SWNE, Southwestern New England accent. In his own mind, he sounded like an extra from the set of Good Will Hunting. "Ah, man, she's gonna kill me." As the car sped off, Jack memorized the license plate, then watched it turn onto Meadow Street and head south toward the highway. He holstered his Glock, pulled out his cell phone, and speed dialed Ephraim. It rang 4 times, then went to voicemail. "What the hell?" Jack muttered. "Come on, pick up." He dialed again and got the same result. He texted in all caps, "Call." Jack walked the rest of the way to the platform. 9 or so cars remained in the lot. Better safe than sorry. As he neared the compact car's parking spot, something on the ground glittered under the platform lights. He pulled out his penlight and panned the beam ahead. Sitting in the dirt was a small mound of glass that reflected green. Auto glass, from where the Subaru's driver's door would have been. Jack turned and started running. The pursuit was hopeless, he knew, but realizing he might have just been talking to Stefan Muller, might have just watched him drive away into the night, overrode rational thought. He turned onto Meadow and sprinted down the sidewalk toward the next intersection, some 300 yards away, glancing at the parked cars as he went. Panting, his lungs burning slightly in the cold air, Jack reached the intersection and stopped. He looked left, saw nothing, looked right. A 1/4 mile away, a white car sat at a stop sign, its right blinker on. The car turned and disappeared. Jack's cell phone trilled. He pulled it out, checked the screen. Ephraim.
"Where are you?" Jack demanded.
I don't know. A few blocks away from the train station. Just a sec. State Street. I thought I saw him, so I followed. It wasn't him."
"No kidding. God damn it."
"Why are you breathing hard?" asked Ephraim.
Chapter 16. Waterbury, Connecticut. By the time Ephraim had made his way back to the intersection, Jack had already logged into the Enquester portal and punched in the Subaru's license plate number. As he climbed into the passenger seat, the results appeared on his screen. Eunice Miller, 6773 Willow Drive, Wolcott, Connecticut, 06716. Without looking up, Jack said, "Find a coffee shop or diner or something." Using his Yelp app, Ephraim located a Denny's on Division Street, about a mile to the west, and started heading that way. Having caught his breath and cooled off, Jack said as calmly as possible, "The next time I call you, answer the phone."
"I couldn't. I was afraid I'd lose him."
Jack repeated, "The next time I call you, answer the damn phone."
"Okay, I will. Sorry."
"And I didn't tell you to follow anyone. I told you to keep in touch."
"You didn't tell me not to follow anyone either."
Jack bit off the sharp reply on the tip of his tongue. Ephraim had a point. They lived in different worlds. What Jack considered obvious or implied might be neither to Ephraim. Ephraim didn't have the experience to know when initiative crossed into recklessness, or perhaps even the discipline to pull himself back across the line. A thought struck Jack. He could easily imagine John Clark or Jerry Hendley saying the same things about him, and they wouldn't be wrong.
"What's happened?" asked Ephraim.
"I think I might have been talking to Mueller. He was right there, within arm's reach," Jack replied, then explained the encounter. If it had been Mueller, had he recognized Jack? Back at the nature preserve, Mueller's attention had been divided between Ephraim and his SUV, and Jack and his Glock, and Jack's cap had been pulled low. It was a toss-up.
If it was him, why stop at all?
To check me out, maybe.
Maybe. But they've tried to kill you twice.
It sounds like you were an easy target standing in that lot. Why not take advantage of it?
Good point.
Then again, if Mueller's sole focus was escape, Jack caught himself.
Leave it.
The world in which he and the others at the campus moved was one where there could always be a wheel within another wheel. At some point, you had to stop the recursive thinking and make a choice. For someone like Jack, who was blessed or cursed with a fertile imagination, this was often challenging. It wasn't unlike chess, a game he both loved and hated. He had read somewhere that the number of available piece positions was represented by a 1 followed by 43 zeros, and this was governed by strict rules and limited space. Neither of these factors existed in Jack's world. Still, Mueller's theft of the Subaru seemed like a departure for him. So far, the man's E&E, evasion and escape plan, had felt paint by numbers, with little room for improvisation. He'd used a credit card to call attention to his location, a risky but often effective strategy, especially when those pursuing you are part of a larger, less nimble force, like the Secret Service or FBI, both agencies you'd expect to be called on to hunt down the would-be assassin of a VIP. Perhaps Mueller and whoever he was working for had planned his exfiltration based on this assumption. Schrader was ex-German Special Forces. Mueller might be as well, in which case their doctrine might be steeped more in rote response than it was in flexibility. If so, stealing a card didn't fit. Unless Mueller's calf wound had worsened enough that he went off script. Ephraim pulled into the Denny's lot and chose an open parking spot before the main doors.
"Coffee? Anything to eat?"
"Just coffee." Jack used Inquester to pull up Eunice Miller's Department of Motor Vehicles file. The picture showed a woman with a plump face and short gray curly hair. Her birth date put her at 65 years old. According to Jack's map, her address in Wolcott was about 15 minutes north of Waterbury, off Highway 69. Ephraim returned with 2 large cups of coffee. He handed one to Jack, then climbed into the driver's seat. Jack showed him Eunice Miller's picture. Ephraim said, "Sweet old lady?" The question is, was she on that train? And did Mueller do something to her? Had she been in the car with Mueller, alive and bound, or dead in the back seat? Shit. Jack chastised himself for not having checked the scrub brush bordering the train platform. If Eunice Miller had been lying there dying, only feet from where Jack had been standing,
I need a payphone, he said. There was one a few blocks back.
Ephraim pulled out, retraced their route and did a U-turn and pulled to the curb beside the payphone. Jack got out, mentally rehearsed, then dialed 911. When the dispatcher answered, Jack put some gravel in his voice and said, Hey, I was jogging by the train station on Meadow. I thought I heard a woman screaming, either on the platform or on the train, I don't know which.
He hung up. Please don't find anything.
At this time of night, the roads were largely deserted, so they made the trip to Wolcott in 10 minutes. Eunice's house, what looked like a post-World War II single-story salt box on Google Earth, sat 2 blocks behind a bowling alley off the town's main thoroughfare. When Ephraim pulled up to the stop sign at the head of her block, Jack ordered him to cross the intersection and then pull to the curb and turn off the headlights.
How are we going to do this?
Jack didn't respond immediately. He didn't have an answer. Okay, let's drive past, see if we spot her car, Jack said. Ephraim turned the Sonata around, then turned onto Willow. Should be the 5th or 6th house on your side. Looking out Ephraim's window, Jack watched for house numbers. When they drew even with 6773, Ephraim started to slow. Don't, Jack warned. There was no white Subaru in the driveway, and no garage. 2 houses down, there was a Subaru. The plate matched the one from the train station. Parked ahead of the Subaru was a green RAV4 SUV. The home, which was a duplicate of Eunice's except for light yellow paint instead of white, was dark save the porch light and some yellow light around the edges of the front room curtains.
That's not her house, Ephraim said.
No, wrong number.
So, I don't know.
Keep going. Turn the corner. Pull over. Ephraim did so, easing the Sonata beneath the low-hanging boughs of an elm tree, and then killing the headlights. Jack punched this new mystery address into Inquester. The deed record came back to Caitlin Showalter. Jack had tilted the phone so Ephraim could watch. Ephraim said, Caitlin's a younger name. Jack went to Facebook and searched for her name, then sorted through several of them before finding the profile that listed a hometown of Wolcott, Connecticut. Caitlin was single. Her occupation? Insurance agent in Bridgeport. Her last post, prefixed by a smiley face emoticon, was from 2 hours ago. Long day, but almost over. Car wouldn't start, late for work, missed lunch. Now, some General Tso's chicken and an egg roll for my savior, Eunice. Caitlin had borrowed Eunice's car to get to the train station for her daily commute. Ephraim said, Could it have been her boyfriend? Maybe, Jack replied. Then, No. The guy said wife. He was picking up his wife. Unless Caitlin had failed to change her relationship status on Facebook, which seemed unlikely given how much time she spent there, she was still single.
So how can we be sure it's Müller inside?
The quickest way to answer the question was also the one Jack didn't like. Break into Caitlin Showalter's house and, if Müller was inside, snatch him up. Of course, as before, that approach left him with a captive and all the problems that came along with that. The other option was to wait until Müller moved again and follow. If the man was using Caitlin's house as an impromptu safe house aid station, he was likely to make it brief. For a moment, Jack reconsidered his approach to Müller. Maybe this was one of those times when violence would solve problems. Kill Müller and be done with it. It would make it harder to find the answers he needed, and if there was such a thing as good luck, Jack had already strained his. Committing cold-blooded murder on U.S. soil would give him a constellation of bigger problems, starting with a moral line he could never uncross. Jack turned in his seat and reached into his rucksack, rummaged for a moment, then came up with a GPS tracker, the same kind he'd planted in Peter Hahn's car.
What's that? Asked Ephraim.
Jack explained, and Ephraim said, Let's just hope he doesn't switch cars again. Plus,
We are making a lot of assumptions about...
Welcome to my world, Jack said. Wait here. I'll be right back.
Chapter 17. Wolcott, Connecticut. With the tracker in place, they found another all-night diner off Lakewood Road, ordered a late dinner, early breakfast, then settled in to wait. It was just after 3 a.m. If Mueller didn't move before dawn, they'd go back to the house. They sipped their coffee in silence until Jack could feel the caffeine hit his bloodstream. He took a few moments to assemble his thoughts, then said, "Ready for some questions?" Ephraim replied,
"As long as they don't require deep thinking. If I don't get my usual 14 hours of sleep a night, I'm not at my best."
"Tell me how you got onto the Allman story."
"I got curious.
Of course, soldiers disappear all the time, especially in places like Afghanistan or Iraq, or Ivory Coast. It's like your old West out there. But it struck me that Allman's disappearance wasn't getting the attention it warranted. In French military circles, his family is renowned, and it's a juicy mystery story. No one, not even his father, Marshal Armand, spoke out very much.
Maybe the Marshal simply accepted it. It comes with the job.
Would you accept it if your son went missing? You would want answers."
"True," Jack replied.
"So you got curious, and then what? Went down to Ivory Coast?"
"Exactly. I tried to get some interviews through military channels, but got nowhere. So I managed to track down some of Rene's friends that were still stationed at Port Bouet Airport, Abidjan. That's where Operation Unicorn was headquartered. What they said about Rene's disappearance didn't add up. He didn't fit the profile as either a deserter or someone reckless enough to get kidnapped. They all knew the off-limits areas of Abidjan. In fact, Rene was usually the voice of reason, the one talking others out of straying."
Jack noted Ephraim's use of Almond's first name. It was as though Ephraim was speaking about a close friend. The young journalist was invested not only in discovering the truth behind Almond's disappearance, but also in finding the man. Did that mean Ephraim had lost objectivity? Jack wondered.
"Keep going," he said.
"In the previous 18 months, two other soldiers had gone missing. One had been kidnapped by COJEP, or COJEP, the Young Patriots. It's an anti-UN group, and then released. The other deserted and was apprehended a week later in Korhogo."
"In other words, you found no cases of a soldier simply vanishing."
"Not one. But here's where it gets interesting. After I'd interviewed all the military personnel willing to talk, I started visiting social hangouts favored by the soldiers, most of them in Kumasi Commune."
"Which is what?" asked Jack.
"Communes are sort of like boroughs in New York City. Kumasi is one of three on Little Bassam Island in the middle of Abidjan Harbor. It's about 2 miles from Port Bouet Airport."
"Got it."
"Eventually, I found one local, a cafe owner in Kumasi named Fabrice, who claimed to have seen René kidnapped off the street by men in balaclavas."
"Did he report it?"
"He claimed to have, but I couldn't corroborate it. I believed him, though."
"Why?" asked Jack.
"One, I did a little digging into the man. And two, instinct. I assume you did something similar after we met."
Jack had indeed. He nodded.
"So Fabrice gives you this story. What did you do with it?"
"Not much.
Shortly after I interviewed Fabrice, I had to go back to France. When I started investigating the story, one of the first things I did was contact his fiancée, Madeleine. Of everyone involved, she seemed the most frustrated over René's disappearance, or more accurately, the lack of outcry. We hit it off, I suppose you could say. Anyway, Madeleine claimed to have heard from René."
"How?"
"Text message. It wasn't from his phone, of course, but she was certain it was him. His phrasing, his punctuation, a few words here and there convinced her it was René. What did he say?
Ephraim pulled the small brown leather notebook from his jacket pocket, opened it, then flipped to a page. His first message was, "Am alive. Tell no one. Trouble. Y-I-A-R."
What's that mean, Y-I-A?
Yours in all. Yours in body, mind, and spirit. It was their shorthand for I love you.
This was a credible detail. Not proof of life exactly, but it certainly had the ring of truth to it. She got other messages, I assume.
Three others. One, a message he wanted passed to his father. The other, a time and place Madeline and he were to meet.
Before you ask, she refused to tell what the message was. She did give me the details of the meeting, though.
Why trust you with that, but not the message to Marshal Almond?
I don't know, replied Ephraim. At any rate, I went ahead of her to the meeting place, Parc de la Fessine in Lyon. I kept my distance and took pictures. Here.
Ephraim slid his phone across to Jack. The first two pictures are of René before his deployment to Ivory Coast, then during. The last three are of him meeting with Madeline.
Jack scrolled through the album. Each picture showed a young man in his late 20s with a lantern jaw and thin lips. In the first two images, his black hair was buzz cut. In the last three, longer, almost to his shoulders.
Ephraim was right. If these most recent images were not of René Almond, then they were of his clone.
I'm convinced, Jack said.
Good. René and Madeline met for about 10 minutes before parting. I followed him to the brasserie near Claude Bernard University. That's where I first saw Eric Schrader. I figured I already had a strong enough link to René through Madeline, so I decided to follow Schrader.
Which is how you eventually got here, Jack finished.
Correct. After Zurich and Munich.
Where Schrader did what?
In Zurich, he went to an office building in the business district.
I don't know which office specifically, however. I have a list. And he also stayed at that apartment I mentioned, the one you don't think belongs to him.
Yes.
As far as Munich goes, aside from his apartment, Schrader went to the gym, a couple nightclubs, and a restaurant and market near his place.
Have you and Madeline talked since you left Lyon?
A few times. But she's cooled off on me. Evasive. I think whatever René said to her scared her badly. And believe me, she's no mouse. You have to be tough to get accepted by the Almond clan, especially the Marshal.
Jack was nodding, but his mind was elsewhere, assembling a tentative plan of action. Once they'd taken the Muller pursuit as far as it could go, Jack would want to re-interview everyone Ephraim had talked to, starting with Fabrice, the café owner in Abidjan, and Madeleine in Lyon, before scouting the locations in Zurich and Munich. So all he'd been doing was walking in the dark, grasping at whatever came into reach, and hoping it would lead him to a light switch. Jack realized he'd become so engrossed in the saga of René Almond that he'd momentarily lost sight of his overriding objective, discovering who was trying to kill him and why. The truth was, the only direct connection between himself and René Almond was Eric Schrader. Beyond that, were the attempt on Jack's life and the disappearance of Almond interwoven, or were they simply a coincidence? If the former, how exactly? Jack had already asked Ephraim this very question, and now he put it to him again. Ephraim replied, "If there's a deeper connection, I haven't found it. As I said, you can study my notes. Maybe I've missed something."
"You told me you thought Almond might have been false flagged. What makes you think that?"
"Madeline let slip something the last time we talked. She said René had told her he isn't who he claims to be."
Jack's cell phone beeped. He checked the screen, then said, "Muller's on the move."
Chapter 18. Wolcott, Connecticut. Once in the car, Jack watched his phone's screen as the red blip that represented Mueller's car, or what he hoped was Mueller inside Eunice Miller's car, left Willow Drive and slowly made its way to Highway 15, where it headed north. Jack let Mueller get a mile's head start, then followed. Mueller headed almost due north, making his way first to 84 before picking up I-91 at Hartford. An hour later, they crossed the border into Massachusetts. An hour after that, they were into Vermont, following 91 along the Connecticut River, which separated Vermont and New Hampshire. Soon, swaths of snow began to appear in the ditches along the highway and in crescents around the bases of pine trees. City limits signs for distinctly colonial-sounding towns passed outside the Sonata's windows. Putney, Walpole, Charleston. And with each passing mile, the terrain grew more rural, until each side of the highway was hemmed in by thick forest.
"Where the hell is he going?" Ephraim asked. "Canada?"
"I don't know, but I'm thinking about ending this," Jack replied.
"What's that mean?"
"Deserted rural road in the middle of the night," Jack said. "Force him off the road and..."
"And what?" Ephraim blurted, clearly alarmed. "Drag him into the forest and tie him to a tree? You're kidding, right?"
"More or less." At 5 a.m., Jack's phone trilled. Ephraim checked it.
"Google News Alert."
Jack felt his heart drop.
"I set one for the Waterbury train station in the Metro North. Read it."
Ephraim scanned the story.
"It's from WTNH. Let's see. Oh, God, Jack."
"What?"
"Unidentified woman found in bathroom of an out-of-service Metro North train. Badly beaten. Airlifted to Hartford. Police investigating."
Jack clenched his hands on the steering wheel.
"Bastard."
20 minutes later, Ephraim said, "He's slowing down. Getting off the highway."
"He stopped. Turning east."
Jack pressed down on the accelerator, and soon the Sonata's headlight panned over a sign. "Exit 8, Vermont 131, Ascutney, Windsor."
"That's it," said Ephraim.
"Where is he?"
"Half mile ahead, turning left onto... I don't see a label. I'll let you know when."
Jack took the exit, then turned east. Another couple hundred yards brought them to a north-south intersection.
"Turn left."
Jack did so. A sign beside the road reading Connecticut River Byway was followed shortly after by one reading Ascutney, population 540. Now they were paralleling the river, heading north along Ascutney's main thoroughfare. Where they'd seen little traffic on Highway 91, here there was none. Ahead, what few traffic lights existed all glowed green. At each intersection, Jack looked left and right and saw only darkened roads and the occasional lighted window or porch light.
"Slow down," Ephraim said. "He's only a few hundred yards ahead."
Jack took his foot off the gas pedal and let the car coast until the speedometer fell below 15 miles per hour.
"He's turning left onto Black Mountain Road. There's a campground up here. The turn is just after that."
"Okay. You can pick up speed a bit." Jack did so, and soon his headlights flashed over another sign. To the right, Stafford Construction. To the left, Black Mountain Road.
"Ephraim, do a search for Stafford Construction."
"Checking on it."
"He's going very slow, Jack. You think he's lost?"
Jack doubted this. Men like Stefan Mueller rarely got lost. Jack flicked off his headlights, turned onto Black Mountain Road, and again dropped his speed. The moon was partially obscured by clouds, and the trees crowding the road left Jack almost blind. He concentrated on the yellow center line and kept going. They drove in silence for 2 minutes. Ephraim said,
"My data connection is getting spotty. I think he's turning again. Right this time, about 100 yards ahead. Looks like a quarry, maybe? What's he want with a quarry?"
"Hell if I know."
To their right, the shoulder sloped away into a shallow draw, choked with knee-high weeds. At the bottom, Jack could make out what looked like a curving road, its dun-colored gravel bright in the moonlight.
"Not this one," Ephraim said. "The turn-in is just ahead."
"I know." Jack stopped the car, then put it into reverse and backed up until only the hood was exposed beyond the ridgeline. They watched the road. A few moments later, headlights panned over the gravel, and then, as Muller's white Subaru came into view from the left, the headlights went dark. The car disappeared from view behind the trees. Jack asked, "Are you on map view or satellite?"
"Map. It's all my phone's connection can do to keep up. It looks like the bottom of this draw is the entrance to the quarry."
"Switch to satellite view and tell me what you see."
"It's going to take a minute."
Jack put the car in drive again, then turned onto the shoulder and down into the draw, carefully picking his way between the scrub bushes. He put the transmission in neutral and shut off the engine, letting momentum carry the car forward. Jack steered right until they were almost brushing the draw's slope, then braked to a stop and put the car in park. He rolled down both their windows and listened for a few moments. He heard nothing but the croaking of frogs. He asked Ephraim,
"You still have him?"
"Hold on. The satellite view is resolving. I'm seeing what looks like construction equipment. Bulldozers, excavators, trucks.
You think he's meeting someone?"
"Either that, or he's picking up another vehicle."
"I don't see anything but heavy equipment down there."
"That overhead view could be months old," Jack replied. "Come on, let's go have a look." Jack grabbed his binoculars from his rucksack, opened his door, climbed out, then headed left toward the slope. Ephraim followed a few steps behind. When they reached the edge of the gravel road, Jack stopped, knelt down. Across the road was a mound of dirt as tall as a two-story house. Jack whispered to Ephraim,
"Step where I step. Stop when I stop."
Ephraim nodded firmly, but Jack could see the barest glint of fear in his eyes.
"You'll do fine."
Jack crept toward the edge of the road, then peeked right into the quarry. The entrance road they were standing beside opened into a tiered pit divided into navigable tracts by mounds of gravel and sand. Here and there, dirt berms covered in stubby trees were backlit by the night sky. Jack saw no sign of the Subaru. He checked again through the binoculars. Nothing. Hunched over, he crossed the road to the dirt mound and made his way around its backside, where he again stopped. He felt a tap on his shoulder and turned. Ephraim mouthed something to Jack, then handed him the phone. Jack took it and studied the screen. In Jack's ear, Ephraim whispered,
"Stafford Construction. It's just over that hill. Do you see what I see?"
Jack zoomed in on the image. The compound of Stafford Construction was sandwiched between Black Mountain Road and the Connecticut River on a swath of land about a quarter mile wide and a mile long. Along the western edge nearest this quarry sat a collection of outbuildings. To the east, beside the river, the compound was bisected by a long paved road bordered by what looked like construction trailers and elongated storage containers.
Something was off about the image, Jack realized, trying to pin it down.
From the darkness came the slamming of a car door. Startled, Ephraim looked over his shoulder.
"Was that Muller? Is he moving?"
Jack ignored him. He zoomed in on the Stafford compound and began scrolling the image. Then he saw it. Painted onto the pavement at each end of the compound road was a white X. Jack knew the symbol. Permanently closed runway. Muller was here for the next leg of his E&E plan, but it didn't involve a vehicle. In the distance, Jack heard the faint whine of an aircraft engine. Jack said,
"Stay close."
Chapter 19. Ascutney, Vermont. They continued forward, following the base of the mound until they reached the next track. Here Jack paused, then sprinted left, eyes scanning for the Subaru's white paint or for movement. Muller would be moving east, Jack guessed, toward the sloped tree line bordering the compound. But where exactly? The cell phone's satellite image wasn't fine enough to show footpaths, only roads. From somewhere ahead, Jack heard the scuff of a shoe on gravel, then the trickling of loose sand. Jack froze, crouched. Ephraim bumped into him, whispered, "Sorry." Jack closed his eyes, trying to latch on to the memory of the sound.
"Which direction?"
Left, he decided, around the mound of sand before them. Jack stood up and kept going until he reached the mound, which he skirted to the right. The sound of the aircraft engine was increasing now in both pitch and volume. Jack looked up, but his view of the compound was obscured by the mound. Ephraim tapped him on the shoulder, then pointed right. The trunk of Muller's Subaru jutted out from behind the next gravel pile.
"Think it through," Jack commanded himself. "Don't rush."
If Muller was aware of their pursuit, this quarry would be the perfect ambush point. The terrain was ideal, as was the timing. When better to tie up loose ends? If Muller was lying in wait, he would be either on forested high ground along the quarry's east edge or behind them, waiting for them to make their way toward the compound. It wasn't lost on Jack what kind of man he was dealing with. Muller was ruthless and cool, that was a given. But Jack had a hunch that Muller and Eric Schrader shared similar backgrounds. German Special Forces. This knowledge didn't make him feel any better about the task before him.
Doesn't matter.